music is from an unlikely source. A man best known not for composing, but for his philosophy, his name Friedrich Nietzsche. And he had an effect on American thinking of the 19th and 20th centuries, just as American thinking of the 19th had an effect on Nietzsche. We'll look at that controversial figure, a man whose philosophy has been interpreted in opposing ways by people, depending upon what they wanted to find in it. We'll see if we can find a common thread in the thinking of Friedrich Nietzsche with our guest, Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join Emily Auerbach and me for the coming hour of University of the Air here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Esteemed Herr Doctor, perhaps it is of little concern to you that here in America three people often sit together and allow Nietzsche's writings to edify them at their most intimate, but I don't see why we shouldn't at least tell you so once. We are counting on the fact that due to the depth of your thoughts and your sublime diction, we will never be able or want to read anything else ever again. So wrote an American fan in 1881 to controversial German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, her letter arriving at a time when he was feeling frustrated by his dismal failure to sell his books. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Born in 1844, German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche challenged traditional notions of religion, morality, and life itself. Nietzsche's works, such as The Birth of Tragedy, On the Origin of Moral Feelings, Unfashionable Observations, Human All Too Human, and Beyond Good and Evil, had a profound effect on modern thought. Why did Nietzsche point to American transcendentalist Ralph Waldo Emerson as the most important and fertile philosopher? What uses did Americans make of Nietzsche's radical ideas about democracy, the death of God, and the Übermensch, or Superman? How did Nietzsche's personal life, including his insanity, influence the American response? Joining us is Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, professor of history at the UW-Madison, and the author of American Nietzsche, A History of an Icon and His Ideas, a book that the Wall Street Journal called an elegant and revealing account of America's reckoning with the German thinker.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's very wonderful to be here.
Well, I have to commend you for even taking on a challenge such as Nietzsche. I mean, it's such a large, complicated, perhaps at times erratic figure. And when you start talking about philosophy, period, you touch on so many other things, and it's so easy to get into abstractions. What was the appeal of Nietzsche for you?
Precisely that.
Big nebulous things.
It's funny that you say that, because when I started on this project many years ago, it was originally a dissertation topic. And my Dr. Vater, my advisor back then, said this was not a good idea because I won't please anybody. Yeah, well, I please the one, I'll offend the other.
And
that Nietzsche is such
a
charged topic. Didn't I want to maybe think about someone else to write about if I was going to? But I think that was the very problem for me. Why is Nietzsche such a charged figure for us intellectually? The other thing that was interesting to me, what drew me in, is that I'm actually a U.S. intellectual historian. I'm a trained Americanist. And so in a certain sense, my even paying any attention to Nietzsche during my daylight hours was essentially I was cheating, right? Mm-hmm. Because I was supposed to be looking at our American thinkers, right? I was supposed to be looking at our Emersons and our Thoreaus and our William Jameses and our Reinhold Niebuhrs. And Nietzsche was European. He's not an American thinker. And I know these are sort of clumsy divides, but, you know, we got to make our way through grad school somehow. And what puzzled me was, if that's the case, why is he everywhere? You know, he's on our bookshelves. He's in our libraries. He's in our bookstores. He's in our college syllabi. He's on our T-shirts. He's in our movies.
Cover of Time magazine.
So if this, he may be a quote unquote German thinker, but he's obviously also a kind of public intellectual today. And so I was curious, how did that happen?
Well, do you think part of it has to do with the nature of his writings are such that people can take what they want from him? I mean, don't people sometimes take contradictory ideas from Nietzsche, much as they do with the Bible?
Oh, absolutely. And one of his most famous translator, Walter Kaufmann, who I write about a lot in the book and maybe we'll talk about in a bit, said Nietzsche is very easy to read and very hard to understand.
Yeah, because he was so epigrammatic.
Yeah, right. So part of it is that Nietzsche is an extraordinary writer, although some have accused him of, you know, literary excesses and being too showy and overwrought and et cetera, et cetera. Most commentators, even those who are critical, will agree that this was a man of extraordinary literary gifts. So there's that. There's the fact that Nietzsche created new words for things, yeah?
And repurposed
old words like ressentiment and master and slave morality and Übermensch, Superman, will to power, Wille zur Macht. So he gave new words to people to conceptualize themselves and their world. And then I think the last point is perhaps the most obvious point, the point that you make is that so much of his writing was an aphorism. You know, you can grab it and go. Put it on a bumper sticker, yeah. You know, put it on a tote bag.
Sound bites.
So it allows for the impression that these are disconnected, random thoughts that are just easily, you know, appropriated. And then and this is part of the Nietzsche reception, which is, are these just dislocated random thoughts? Or are, in fact, they part of a much larger philosophical vision?
You have a sentence in your book that I jotted down because I really liked it. It's, over the course of the century, progressives and anarchists, Christians and atheists, provincials and cosmopolitans, hawks and doves, academic scholars and armchair philosophers discovered in Nietzsche a thinker to think with. That kind of reinforces what Norman was saying about people sort of on all sides of the political spectrum, the religious spectrum, finding something in Nietzsche that provoked them to think, almost as if he's this gadfly figure that simply makes people either angry or excited or both.
I think that's part of the story that I seek to tell here. Or, I mean, it's also the actual history of what happened. So it was a pretty easy story to tell once I had done the research, which is that no one owns Nietzsche. There's a left Nietzsche. There's also a right Nietzsche. There's a feminist Nietzsche. There's an anti-feminist Nietzsche. There's a, you know, Aryan white power Nietzsche, as there was the black power Nietzsche. And so the question is, how is it possible that so many people over the course of the century could put him to work for so many different purposes? The risk of making a claim like that, of course, is that Nietzsche is just a kind of empty vessel, you know, that it's just so elastic that it really his philosophy didn't really mean anything. And that, I hope, have shown that that's not the case. But I think the reason why Nietzsche has had so much power over so many different kinds of readers is, well, one is just the sheer range of topics that he addressed: art, love, democracy, God, science, truth. He even talked about diet and dress. I mean, this is the enormous range of the topics that he addressed. But it's also that Nietzsche addressed the core topics, you know, the key issues that were most pressing for so many American readers over the course of the century, and that is the nature of truth. And he did it in a variety of ways. But as everybody wants to know what the nature of truth is, Nietzsche became that kind of figure for thinkers, as I say, to think with, or readers to think with. So I try to play with that a little bit, because sometimes it's thinking against, sometimes it's thinking through. But I don't want to say that this direction of Nietzsche, that it's somehow unidirectional, right? That you read Nietzsche and his ideas come at you and shape you. But rather, one of the things that we see even with that Jenny Hintz letter that you read is that readers brought their own experiences, their own longing, their own pathos, their own needs to the text.
I gather that was actually one of Nietzsche's tenets, was teaching people to think for themselves.
Exactly. There's a term that I use in the book, and that is conventional iconoclasm. That is to say, one of the things that so many readers are drawn to in Nietzsche is the idea of his iconoclasm, his independence, his putting an emphasis on individuality, the notion that one should not think secondhand. Yeah. And what reader doesn't want to think that that's him or her that he's referring to? Right.
Course, yeah.
So I think Nietzsche appeals to readers' own sense of themselves, or at least their own longing to be that kind of free, self-directed thinker.
Now, right at the beginning, this name Emerson came up. Now, we talked about, and your book is based on this idea of Nietzsche's influence on Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But in turn, these things kind of bounce back and forth, don't they? Because Emerson, speaking of being epigrammatic and very broadly
and
philosophical, and interested in a lot of topics, big topics, was clearly an influence on Nietzsche. What did Nietzsche get from Emerson?
So many things. So my book opens with Nietzsche's earliest encounter with Emerson when he was actually just a teenager. Nietzsche went to an elite prep school by the name of Schulpforte in Naumburg, Germany, which is in eastern Germany. And he discovered Emerson actually outside of the classroom and was immediately drawn in. And in fact, so taken with Emerson that he pens his first philosophical writings in direct response to Emerson's text. So, I mean, some of it is you see him actually reworking some of the language. You see him answering questions that Emerson posed in some of his late essays. So that's a pretty – these are pretty remarkable intellectual records, right, which is to see Nietzsche cutting his teeth philosophically age 16 with Emerson texts.
And these are things that Emerson would have written from anywhere from about the 1830s into probably the late 60s or so. I mean,
right.
Emerson dies in 82 and
right.
stopped philosophizing somewhat before that.
And Nietzsche actually works his way back. So the Emerson that he first discovers as a teenager is actually the later Emerson. And that's Emerson scholars tend to view this as a slightly darker Emerson, a chastened Emerson, an Emerson who's wrestling with a Darwinian universe, the worries about a deterministic universe, an Emerson where the language of race crops up a lot more than it does in the earlier Emerson. So that's kind of interesting that's the Emerson that Nietzsche discovers. But he works his way back to the earlier Emerson. In other words, he starts then reading Emerson's, you know, what's available in translation because Nietzsche couldn't read English very well, which is also interesting that he's reading a highly mediated Emerson. But the two things I would say that he gets from Emerson, which are so crucial, is he gets from Emerson content, which is a thinker who privileges autonomy above all.
Self-reliance.
A thinker who doesn't want to bow to any dead gods or old traditions, a thinker who is also – who, even though he's a little bit darker towards the end, is ebullient and wants to make philosophy friends with life. Yeah, not something that's going to wrestle you down, but something that will ennoble you and enliven you. And Emerson, who is a critic of forms of Christianity, so at least that's how the young Nietzsche takes him, that is to say, always question your inherited truth. And for Nietzsche, the son of a long line of Lutheran pastors who grew up in an extremely pious Christian environment, that meant questioning religious truth.
You bring up in your book the irony of Nietzsche taking so much from Emerson, but then being sort of cast as this foreigner, this European, by Americans who somehow had lost sight of that. Influence from Emerson, that it wasn't that widely known how deeply influenced Nietzsche was by Emerson.
Right. So this is, I think, one of the curious ironies that I tried to figure out, which is Nietzsche, who is so influenced by Emerson. One of the things that I say is also that Nietzsche reads Emerson pretty much every year of his sane life, because Nietzsche has a catastrophic mental collapse 11 years before he actually physically dies.
1888.
But if we can look and we see that Nietzsche is reading Emerson every year with the exception of a four-year gap. And he's sometimes transcribing things that he wrote. He's sometimes revisiting old essays. So we know there's a heavy engagement. He doesn't agree with everything Emerson says, but we can certainly see that Emerson is a very important influence on Nietzsche. And Nietzsche even says it himself.
Does he cite him then?
Yeah, he does. He refers to him as a brother soul. He uses an Emerson quotation for an epigraph of his first edition of The Gay Science. He refers to Emerson as one of the masters of prose of the 19th century. I mean, the superlatives go on. He writes to a friend in the 1880s, if only I could be like Emerson's transcendent eyeball, observing everything.
Without coloring it.
Right.
Yes, a transcendent eyeball. Transparent eyeball.
Thank you. So we have Nietzsche being very clear that this is a thinker who matters a lot to him. In fact, I mentioned this in the book. The one time – so there's a couple of things that's striking. One is Nietzsche has a penchant for falling in love with other thinkers and other artistic figures, and then wanting to kill his own gods. Yeah. Passion with for Schopenhauer, and then he just takes Schopenhauer down. Wagner, you know, very intense friendship with Wagner, and then he has to essentially kill his intellectual fathers.
I think wasn't that a whole Wagnerian falling out inspired by or prompted by Nietzsche's desire, aspiration to be a composer, and he took some things to Wagner, and Wagner kind of said, "Ooh."
Well, one could write a whole book on the different interpretations why the fallout. Uh-huh. Others have theorized that it's because Nietzsche secretly loved Wagner's wife, Cosima. Uh-huh. Others have said that Nietzsche just saw through to the, frankly, the ickiness of Wagner's anti-Semitism. And
he did react to anti-Semitism, didn't he, Nietzsche? He had a publisher who charged with anti-Semitic thinkings and said, I want to distance myself from that.
Yeah, we have lots of examples of Nietzsche going on record and showing impatience with anti-Semitism. In some of his writings, he even refers to the Jews as the great cosmopolitans of Europe. And cosmopolitanism was something that he really admired, a kind of intellectual citizen of the world. How Nietzsche then ends up getting appropriated by the Nazis, that's
well, you're right.
That's another story.
Gets us back to that. You can interpret him as you want.
You mentioned his breakdown, you know, the fact that he became insane at the end of his life. And in your book, you talk about how Nietzsche's life is part of the influence that he had on Americans, that became part of the whole discussion. What else besides his turning his back on his Lutheran upbringing and then this mental illness at the end, what else about his life would you say is most important to know?
I'm so glad that you pick up on it, because that's actually something from the book that I didn't go in. As I was writing the book, I didn't think I was writing about Nietzsche, the person Nietzsche. I thought I was writing about Nietzscheism or Nietzschean ideas. And in fact, that blind spot, I think, it ended up being a very generative one for me intellectually as a historian, because I had to confront that I was an inherited blind spot, I think, from my training or from the practice of intellectual history. So we tend to look at ideas and intellectual movements.
Keep
and
the text. Life separate.
Yeah, yeah. Keep the life separate, exactly. Or that's the sort of, you know, that's the People magazine version on the side. You can do it after hours, but it's not the serious stuff of intellectual history. And frankly, I brought that assumption already into my writing phase after having done a lot of research, actually many, many too many years worth of research on both sides of the Atlantic. And when I would start writing for a conference paper or, you know, an article or something, in order to kind of limber myself up, I would allow myself just a little bit of free writing of what people had written about Nietzsche, because it's the most colorful and outrageous and heartwarming and upsetting, stuff. And this, again, cuts across. These are I'm talking about professional philosophers. I'm talking about the armchair theologians. And what I would do is to write about kind of what people had said about Nietzsche as a way to just warm me up and then get to the real stuff, which is the ideas. And thankfully, at some point, it dawned on me, wait a second. This is the story. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Let me pay a little bit more attention to who thinks he's a syphilitic madman and who thinks he's a genius and who thinks it was his mother's fault and who thinks it was the fault of the anti-Semites. And let me try to listen to how these stories about Nietzsche's person track with what it is they have to say about the ideas. And unsurprisingly, those who thought he was a syphilitic madman tended to think that the ideas had problems, you know, and those that thought he was a misunderstood genius and that modern culture can't assimilate genius, thought that, you know, his philosophy had something to say. So that's something that I listen to and write about over the course and try to integrate it together with the interpretation of the text. But you asked me about some of the range of interpretations. So obviously his insanity. Everyone becomes a posthumous psychiatrist without the proper credentials, trying to figure out, was Nietzsche clinically insane? And if so, does that disqualify the writings? If he was crazy, when did he go crazy? Right. So are there certain writings that are okay to read and other writings not okay to read? But what always tracks with this question, was he a genius or was he insane or was he a mad genius, was the question of how to make sense of the philosophy in light of that. And for those eager to see something worthy in the philosophy, they tended to see the breakdown itself as a culture punishing genius. And so what writers were able to do is to sort of spin narratives out of that. This is the cost of being an intellectual in the modern world, right? Or this is the cost of speaking truth to a bunch of cultural Philistines who do not want to hear
well,
it, right?
Sure, like the
this
Emily Dickinson line.
This world was never meant for one as good as you.
Right, or the much madness is divine sense to
exactly.
a discerning eye. That, that
exactly.
If you are deemed insane, it's probably because you're seeing more deeply than those around you.
This is the language of George Cram Cook, who was a poet and one of the Provincetown players in the early 20th century. He basically said that this is the mark. Nietzsche was a poet, and to be a poet meant to cross a linguistic divide and inhabit a new kind of logos. And that's insanity. I mean, but that, and that's another definition of insanity, because you look through the world with a different set of eyes. You have a different language. But he said that this was martyrdom, which is to say Nietzsche made that crossing for the rest of us. He sacrificed himself in mm-hmm. order to make that crossing and to give us a new language to understand ourselves and understand our world. But then at the same time, you have very well-known, very esteemed philosophers like the philosopher Paul Karras, who I also write about in the book, very important early 20th century figure, who basically said Nietzsche's problem was his impacted sexuality.
Sure, yeah, it's always
that
a
Nietzsche
popular angle.
Did not, you know, did not have enough contact with women, even you know, questioned his full functioning of his anatomy, and basically said that the philosophy is just a kind of compensatory move. Yeah, mm-hmm. So there's this martial philosophy, this fetishizing and exalting of masculinity, because he himself was, as he referred to it, a sickly, quote-unquote, sissy. So this is,
yeah. You know, I've seen a quote attributed to him. Maybe it's not appropriately done so, but it's the quote, "When a woman inclines toward learning, there must be something wrong with her sex apparatus." Does that sound like a Nietzsche quote?
It sounds like a bad translation of one.
Okay.
But I'm not familiar with that one. I thought I'd heard them all, but I'm not. For some reason, that one doesn't. It should stick out to me. Anyway, but you asked the question, and that is the narratives that get spun are narratives often by writers and thinkers themselves trying to make sense of the sacrifices that they were making for their intellectual life. I have a section in here called Imitatio Nietzsche about early 20th century literary radicals who basically looked to Nietzsche as a kind of model. Like, okay, this is – okay, if we're serious about this, yeah, we can't just kvetch, you know, about our bad paychecks and the dim lighting in our room and the empty bellies. If we really want to produce genius, look at Nietzsche. This is what it costs, you know, and it's a price worth paying.
We'll look at some of those followers of Nietzsche and also perhaps get a little closer look at his life, too, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Whither is God? I will tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. Do we hear nothing as yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we smell nothing as yet of the divine decomposition? That's from Friedrich Nietzsche's The Gay Science from 1882. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen, whose book is American Nietzsche, A History of an Icon and His Ideas. So first of all, tell us about, I guess, his most famous stance, the God is dead idea, the nihilism and so on. And also maybe just as a afterthought, why the title Gay Science?
So the Die fröhliche Wissenschaft, which translates as the joyous science or the gay science, is one of Nietzsche's early efforts to see how might one tear everything down, yeah, but do so with a sense of joy, with a certain sense of levity, with a sense of play. That is to say, instead of being terrified that we get rid of these false foundations of our existence, God, universal truth, you
institutional
know,
iconoclasm.
Pardon? Is that the institutional iconoclasm?
Yeah, that's
you refer
the, yeah. The conventional iconoclasm was just the way in which everyone reads Nietzsche's iconoclasm and thinks that it's referring to him. But if we're all thinking this, then it's a pretty conventional trope in American culture. Yeah, so for Nietzsche, this is the part of Nietzsche where he is in a deconstructive mode or a destructive mode, tearing down truths, kind of uprooting supposed foundations of all human existence. But he says, we don't need to do this in a spirit of despair. We can do it with a spirit of lightness, with a spirit of exploration and a sense of wonder.
So sort of joyous nihilism?
Well, not nihilism. That's
not
the
nihilism.
Point. I mean, that
but
was
if you're
very much
tearing down everything.
In order to build from scratch.
In order to build anew. So this is where he first introduces the language of God is dead. And that's in that aphorism, the madman aphorism. And it's out of this that he then develops... Oh my gosh.
Not Übermensch.
What's the really famous book? Also, Sprach Zarathustra. Sorry. Thus Spoke Zarathustra is essentially working forward with this notion of God is dead. Interestingly, on a side note, Ralph Waldo Emerson in one of his journals had referred to wanting to be a professor of the joyous science. I have never been able to find out whether it's possible that Nietzsche could have seen that. I don't know. So that's just one place where I have to shrug my shoulders as a historian. And I don't know that I have the evidence. Either way, I think it's pretty remarkable,
yes,
right? So whether he just intuited or he in fact came across it. So in that aphorism of the madman, what Nietzsche is playing with is this notion that the madman comes down to the marketplace, the supposed madman, and says to everybody, wait, don't you realize it? God is dead. God is dead. You have killed him. We have killed him, you and I. And we have his blood stains on our hands to prove it. And everyone says, oh, you're crazy. Oh, you're crazy, Leah. And he says, my time has not yet come. And one of the interpretations of this, and I find it a very good interpretation, is the sense that, of course, the madman has to come to people and say, don't you realize it? You don't believe in God anymore. You go to church every Sunday and you bow and you go through all the motions, but it's empty because you've got this conceit of modernity, yeah, that you've moved ahead. You don't actually believe in the literal truths of the Bible. You don't believe in all that miracles, hocus pocus. You're moderns now, but you're not willing to let go then of the structures of Christianity, the rituals and the practices of Christianity, even though you don't believe. But don't you realize that at the core of what you're doing, your God is already dead? So what the interpretation, and again, I find this to be a very good one, it's not that Nietzsche is saying that Nietzsche is announcing that God is dead. Nietzsche is simply saying, God, we've all killed God in our secularization, but we're not yet ready to admit it.
But why a madman is the spokesperson? There's an irony there in the fact that Nietzsche later is going to become insane.
Yeah, well, that's actually a terrible irony.
Mad or perceived as mad by the people he's talking to?
He doesn't let us know. Uh-huh. He doesn't let us know.
But I think there's Mark Twain does the same thing where he has a lot of spokespeople who are supposedly crazy who tell a lot of
truth. Well, the wise fool.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. I think
tradition.
That's what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. I think that's it too. But it also leaves a sense of not knowing, right? Maybe it is just a madman coming and speaking gibberish in the town
square. So what kind of labels would you put on Nietzsche? I know he's a man who resists labels, but if you had to characterize his religious position, would you call him an atheist, an agnostic, a man who changed his views? What kind of religious figure?
A really unorthodox Lutheran?
I would call him what George Berman Foster would call him. And that's one of that's a Baptist minister who was a major Nietzsche, reader of Nietzsche, and got himself into a lot of trouble with the church in the 1900s and 19-teens before he dies in 1919. And basically says that he's a pious believer with nothing yet to believe in. That is to say that the longing for belief, I think, is there in Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of George Eliot was called a spiritual woman without a religion.
Okay, and George Santayana became known as an aesthetic Catholic.
And so this is
right.
Maybe,
I mean, he was an atheist. He was an atheist, but aesthetically, he was still a Catholic.
Yeah. This might be what he's referring to when the madman says, "I'm ahead of my time," because I'm telling you, this religion is dead, but I don't have anything to replace it with yet.
And that is the work of the Übermensch. I mean, that's for the future. So what's interesting, I think, about this, the passage that you read, Emily, I have that in my a chapter where I talk about the early religious reception of Nietzsche. And one of the things that was very surprising to me when I was doing research for the book was just how important religious readers were of Nietzsche. And now it wasn't totally predictable what it is they were going to say. So these are some of the earliest, in a sense, promoters of Nietzsche. That is, Christian clergy, mostly liberal Protestants, but also lay people who were involved in various social justice movements. And what Nietzsche did for that first generation of religious readers was to make them think twice about their Christianity. Was what Nietzsche challenged them to think about was Christianity really up to the task of modernity? You know, if Nietzsche might be right and we don't actually believe all of the things that we're learning in the Bible, or we're now in a post-Darwinian world and it doesn't all quite comport, what are we going to keep and what are we going to get rid of? And I say that this hit liberal Protestants the hardest because liberal Protestants were the ones who most accommodated themselves to secular knowledge. And, you know, that's, in a sense, a long history of Protestantism, but certainly liberal Protestantism over the course of the 19th century is a story of, you know, Protestants really trying to integrate modern sciences into their worldviews.
As opposed to very conservatives who would just write it off entirely and
yeah,
say the Bible
more...
is literally the word of God and so on.
Exactly. I mean, interestingly, not that all – there were certainly some modern thinking Catholics at the time, although – and also appreciative readers of Nietzsche, but it was pretty clear Nietzsche was persona non grata among Catholic theologians of the time. I mean, he's mentioned, but that he's often mentioned actually as an example of what's wrong with Protestantism. You know, once you think this is once you free up the will, yeah, and once you think that, you know, there's a priesthood of all believers, it's just a short step to this kind of megalomania, yeah, mm-hmm. This kind of super aggrandized will that now has the audacity to try to pull down, you know, the celestial staircase. So Nietzsche actually is important for the few Catholic commentators as just an example of what's wrong with what they refer to as the aggressive secularism inherent in Protestantism. But for many liberal Protestants, they read Nietzsche and said, you know what? He's got a point. That is to say, we don't actually believe a lot of the stuff that we're teaching our kids and a lot of the things that we hear about in Sunday church, but we kind of do it out of
habit.
Maybe fear of disbelief.
Fear of disbelief.
That might lead to anarchy and a big hole.
Well, one of the things that I think for liberal Protestant commentators, what Nietzsche had argued was if you're going to get rid of the belief, you got to get rid of the whole infrastructure. In other words, there's no way to hold on to – well, you can, but it doesn't have integrity – to hold on to the ethical structure of Christianity. Yeah. Take care of the next. Be your brother's keeper. You know, all of the things that we identify as a kind of secular ethics, when in fact the basis is really this – Judeo-Christianity.
Sure.
So if you're going to get rid of the belief, you actually also have to get rid of the ethical structure. And that hit hard to many liberal Protestants at the time who were doing just that. So when we look at something like the social gospel movement in the early 20th century, that was an effort to read the Bible as itself a social document.
Sure.
I mean, what to
sure.
do in a time of That's increasing right. urbanization and industrialization. What do we do to fix the ills of modernity? We need to tend to the poor. We need to build soup kitchens. We need to build a social welfare
system. It's a good thing to do, not because it's a religious tenet.
Right, exactly. But wait a second. If Nietzsche's telling us that you can't really have one without the other, yeah, you cannot have the ethical structure without the belief, then right, what is the grounds upon which we're going to build this ethical structure?
Individually and collectively. You suddenly have a lot of different ethical structures in conflict, don't you?
Well, that was what these commentators were worried about. So, I mean, what I can assure you is that Nietzsche did not convince any of these people to abandon their Christianity.
But he got them thinking.
Got them really thinking about the liberalizing impulse in their own Christianity, got them really thinking about how is it that we establish the grounds or the foundations of our ethical beliefs. And one of the people that I write about, I mentioned just briefly, is George Borman Foster, because I would say he's the one who Nietzsche I think he's one of the religious thinkers who really wrestles with Nietzsche in such a profound way that's so ahead of his time. So basically, he is what I see as a forerunner of the death of God theology movement. So in the 1960s, a small but prominent group of radical theologians pick up on Nietzsche after the Holocaust and said, you know, this is a pretty terrible confirmation that Nietzsche might have gotten this right. How can we be Christian anymore? How can we believe in God anymore after something so awful like the Holocaust or so awful like the bomb? And so what they try to do is to basically start where Nietzsche left off, and that was what they called the death of God movement, which is what would a Christianity look like after the belief in the God that we no longer – that's no longer stands to the bar of the modern mind. And this is the mention of a George Berman Foster's – we think of this as a post-Holocaust phenomenon because of their – you know, relative fame. But actually, all of the arguments of the death of God movement of the 60s are already there, present and pretty much in full form in the writings of George Berman Foster, who was a liberal Protestant minister in the early 20th century.
Also some of the socialists. I was going to ask you about Nietzsche and politics. What did he think of American democracy and of the socialists, and sort of where did he come down politically, or was it kind of all of the above?
Well, Nietzsche did not have that much to say about America. He knew very little bit about America, and what he wrote about America just is pretty much the conventional tropes of his own day. He was very focused on Europe. He was very focused on Germany. But he didn't have good things to say about democracy. He thought that democracy was an extension of this egalitarian spirit in Christianity.
And that was wrong because?
Because it is a realization of the slave morality rather than a master morality. So that basically democracy is just another form of Christianity, which is just a later form of early Jewish slavery. And that is that it's the kind of exalting the powerlessness, exalting the weak. And Nietzsche didn't think that everybody was equally fit to rule themselves and to rule one another. I mean, Nietzsche definitely thought that there were different, I don't want to say stages, because that's not really a language he would have used, but there were those of a master morality and those of a slave morality.
So different ranks.
Right. And I mean, for him, democracy and socialism, he's got, you know, he calibrates the criticism for both, but was basically a triumph of that slave morality, which was fueled by what he called ressentiment, or kind of resentment. So he had terrible things to say about democracy, terrible things to say about egalitarianism, terrible things to say about socialists. But amazingly enough, readers, you know, creatively gerrymandered their way,
yeah,
you know, through
his
texts.
Oh, you quote, I think, H.L. Mencken in America is kind of taking that idea of Nietzsche about democracy being sort of a leveling. And I think the Mencken quote that you included was something about only underdogs want equality.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah. Yeah, that it's the rule of the herd.
Which I suppose if you think underdogs just want equality and that's a negative thing, that would explain his concept of the Übermensch. And we're going to explore that when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
God is dead. Behold, I teach you the Übermensch. Man is something that shall be overcome. All beings so far have created something beyond themselves. What is the ape to man? A laughingstock or a painful embarrassment? And man shall be just that for the Übermensch, a laughingstock or a painful embarrassment. The Übermensch is the meaning of the earth. I beseech you, my brethren, remain faithful to the earth, and do not believe those who speak to you of otherworldly hopes. That's a lot to get a hold of in the writings of Friedrich Nietzsche, and it is Nietzsche whom we are tackling this hour of University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, who has specialized in what she calls the American Nietzsche, the American response over the years to the philosophy of Nietzsche. Well, key to the philosophy of Nietzsche is this concept that we've tapped into here, the Übermensch, sometimes called the Superman, and interpreted various ways by various people. But what do you think Nietzsche had in mind with the Übermensch that he's talking about?
I don't know. That's the secret. If I knew for sure, I could. But in fact, there's a long and vibrant industry of people saying that they knew exactly what Nietzsche meant. It's interesting. This concept, the Übermensch, which gets translated as the Superman initially, so until Walter Kaufmann, the Superman, the Beyond Man, some just left it as Übermensch. Until we get to Walter Kaufmann, that's when it becomes the Overman. So even the question of how to translate it is crucial. Whether why men should become man and not human. Yeah. So we even have some Uber Fraus who get in on the act.
You mentioned in your book that it goes back to Goethe's Faust to the concept. Right?
Actually, Goethe. That's the first time in modern literature that there's a reference to an Übermensch.
Doesn't work so well for Faust, though.
No, it doesn't work. It doesn't work so well for Nietzsche in a certain sense, right? But it makes sense, right? That in a culture that so valorizes individuality, celebrates what we would come to identify as a kind of negative liberty, a freedom from rather than a freedom to, that the Übermensch would have particular resonance in this culture. And that's, in fact, what my research paired out, which is that of all the concepts, death of God, master and slave morality, will to power, the Übermensch, the Superman, the Overman, is the one that really is of special concern to Americans. Some have argued, Nietzsche came up with us specially for us, right? And so the idea was that in a world after God, if there is no more arbiter, in the heavens above, telling us what is right or wrong, judging us, how do we know? How do we make valuations? How do we judge good and evil? We don't want to just say that everything is equally good, everything is equally beautiful. No, we want to still be able to make valuation. That's what it is to be human. But you would need to be superhuman, or you'd need to be an Übermensch to shoot past all that has been given before, all certainties, all tradition, all terra firma, all, all of that, to envision the good and evil beyond God. And so that's what we get introduced to in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which is Nietzsche's most popular book. Actually, worldwide, it's his most popular book. And it's the book which goes into translations many times over in the United States. What's interesting is that in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche says very little bit about the Übermensch. I mean, you get a couple of prophetic phrases with his typically winged prose, but it's hard to subject it to exegesis. What exactly did he mean? Could there be an Überfrau and not just an Übermensch? An Übermensch actually leaves room for an Überfrau, by the way. Is this a literal human being? Is this a human being? Is this the potential, the human potential within all of us?
Or something to do with evolution?
Or something to do with evolution, of course. And so this is the kind of debate that takes hold, and it has real traction in the early 20th century, precisely at a time when Americans are worried about the limits of the spread of industrial capitalism. Yeah. They're worried about the leveling tendencies of democracy. They're worried about the cultural impact of a democracy. So prior to Germany, prior to the beginning of World War I, they would look across to Europe and see German culture, which was anything but democratic, and say, now that's a real culture. They've got Kultur. Can democracy pull off that kind of culture? I don't know. So the Übermensch was a way to kind of test and reformulate our commitment to individualism, the fear of mass tendencies in modern life.
Sure.
And
including mass morality.
Including mass morality.
But isn't it also a sort of celebration of ego in an elitist way, that some are simply, it's sort of almost a philosopher king, that some people are simply of almost a higher order?
Sure. And usually those who like that in Nietzsche thought that they were of that, but to give you a range of what people did initially, and again, we see this played out over and over again and develop in a variety of ways. But as I said, so sort of first generation of feminist readers would read the Übermensch and say, well, wait a second, let's think of the Überfrau. If man is no longer going to bow to dead gods, then women should certainly not be bowing to their husbands. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we have a Margaret Sanger who actually uses a phrase from Nietzsche in her early newsletter. And so the Überfrau is actually a very important image for Margaret Sanger as she's trying to wrestle off the dead weight of a sexist culture and to imagine a female self beyond the good and evil of what was available to her in what was then still really, frankly, Victorian America.
Where do we tap into or where do various individuals tap into this notion that, let's say, I am, if not an Übermensch, an aspiring Übermensch, an Übermensch wannabe, and therefore my ideas of good and evil transcend those of the masses, mm-hmm. and therefore I can make judgments based on those notions of good and evil, and therefore I can be, say, a Napoleon or a Hitler because my ideas are above the mm-hmm. law, mm-hmm. those old dead traditions.
Well, what's interesting is that, and again, at any point in this history, we can find people pulling it in that direction and people pulling against it. So well, let's just look right now at that early reception of the Übermensch, and that is really within a five-year period, you have someone like, well, I'm going to work backwards in time. So you have Leopold and Loeb. Yeah, the famous Leopold and Loeb, the murder. Yeah, the University of Chicago students who read Nietzsche and are inspired by this image of the Superman. They think that they're who Nietzsche had in mind. And they decide that they want to create the perfect crime, yeah? Because they're beyond the good and evil of conventional society.
So and so they kill a 14-year-old.
Yeah, yeah, Bobby Franks, exactly. And actually, Clarence Darrow is their defense attorney. And he basically says to the judge, no wonder, you know, that Nietzsche is such a powerful thinker. I'm sure countless boys across the country have read him and thought that they're who Nietzsche had in mind. But clearly, these are unhealthy kids. They're damaged kids. So they took it to an extreme. But basically, what's interesting is that in Darrow's defense, he goes on and on and on, giving some interpretations of Nietzsche.
So the Nietzsche defense, did it work?
No, it didn't work.
I didn't think so.
It didn't work. They ended up in jail. So that's an example. I mean, and Darrow basically says their mistake was to think that Nietzsche was who he had in mind, to read the Übermensch and to mistake yourself, yeah?
Yes.
To mistake Nietzsche's really dangerous ideas as the voice of your own inner conscience.
Right.
Darrow is very clear about that. Just a few years earlier, one of our most important philosophers, Josiah Royce, who is a famous philosopher of the beloved community at Harvard, was a reader of Nietzsche. And interesting, Nietzsche really represented everything that he was still trying to hold out against. He was still very committed to a form of idealism. But he said, look, if we're going to let this kind of modernist thought get hold, we might as well go with the best, and Nietzsche really is the best. But his point about the Übermensch was, you're mistaken. The Übermensch is never meant to be anything other than a concept, an ideal. But Nietzsche intentionally didn't fill in the contours because there were no contours to be filled in, right? That's our job, to envision a perfected society.
It's an abstraction.
Beyond. Exactly. And anytime we wanted to get literal, it just means that we're not there yet. You know, that we're intellectually not there yet. So Royce was someone who was very careful about reading Nietzsche literally, and yet he thought Nietzsche still was a very powerful prod for us to critique and reformulate our inherited morality.
I'm curious about a couple of other Americans who you mentioned as being influenced by Nietzsche. One of them was Jack London.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a sponge for ideas, wasn't he?
yeah, he was a great sponge. Nietzsche was a socialist, so this is someone who was very talented at kind of working his way past Nietzsche's critique of socialism to integrate Nietzsche into his vision of a socialist ideal. And unsurprisingly, he liked the machismo of Nietzsche's language. And I think you see that in Jack London's own writing.
Sure.
That kind
mm-hmm.
of tough, manly, fearless
self-reliant.
Intellect.
Yes, right. What about Khalil Gibran, who is in some ways the opposite of what we would think of Jack London?
Yes. Gibran is, I think, someone who is a surprising figure that he crops up. So for your audience and listeners, you may think, gosh, how do I know the name Khalil Gibran? And it's because you probably just heard lines of his The Prophet from 1923 read at the last wedding that you've gone to, maybe a bris, a college graduation. So one of the most quotable and repurposed poems of the 20th century is Khalil Gibran's The Prophet, which was written in direct response to Nietzsche. He's very candid about that influence there. I mean, it models, the whole thing models Thus Spoke Zarathustra, right? So someone who comes down, al-Mustafa, who comes down to speak truths to people that they're not yet ready to hear, truths about love and marriage and sex and clothing and religion. And it's all that sort of prophetic prose poem. What's interesting about a Gibran, and this is why I like to write about him here, not only because it's so unexpected, right? You know, this sort of tender-hearted, you know, sweet,
yes, very much.
You know, poet where, you know, just wants you know, wants us all to just reach out and give a kind of fuzzy hug. How could it possible that he found himself in Nietzsche?
Right.
But that's precisely the point. I actually think he's a very good reader of Nietzsche, and that is Nietzsche helped him to think about what would, you know, he was an artist, he was a poet. What would our aesthetics look like if they were unshackled from tradition, you know, if they were unshackled from convention? What might imagination allow us to do? What I love so much about Gibran and what connects him to other authors throughout the century is that Gibran, you know, Gibran doesn't read Thus Spoke Zarathustra and say, oh, the Übermensch, that's who I'm, who Nietzsche had in mind. But he does read Nietzsche and say, there's a quote, he picked the fruit off the tree of my mind. He said the thoughts that I was coming to. And you hear that a lot, right, where people say, he anticipate. I swear I was going to say that. I was going to say that. Or that was my own inner thought.
Or like with your quote from Bloom that you end a chapter with.
That's a perfect connection.
Nietzsche is us.
Nietzsche is us. Right. So what's interesting about Gibran, what made Nietzsche a genius was not that he was a genius beyond himself, but that Nietzsche's genius helped him tap into his own and find his own creative voice. And this happens over and over and over again over the course of the century, so much so that by 1987, the Chicago professor of classics, Harold Bloom, writes the famous book, The Closing of the American Mind, and it becomes really a surprise bestseller. I refer to him in the book as an accidental public intellectual. And if you all recall, the main argument of this book is simply about basically how the American education has impoverished the souls of our students. So you and I are to blame, Emily, as two professors here, we're to blame. But he says one of the real problems here is what he referred to as the Nietzscheanization of the American Academy. And so what he says is that Nietzsche comes into American culture. He actually thinks it comes in with the wave of German Jewish emigres who are fleeing Nazism in the 1930s, and that this works its way into American culture, this testing of truths, this claim that, you know, there's no absolute truth, but truth is relative, it is contingent, it is perspectival. And he says it's one thing for those ideas to make their way in German culture, yeah, where there's true Bildung, where people understand hierarchy, where there is a firm ground intellectually beneath the Germans' feet. But in America, the land of intellectual pygmies, yeah, or dilettantes at the university, these kinds of ideas only throw us into more intellectual chaos, yeah? These anti-foundational ideas only send us more into a dizzying array, and it basically makes it so that the university is a place of libertinism, right? And that's what we're teaching our students. So we're closing their mind by essentially allowing their minds to stay too radically open. Yeah, that's the argument of the book. And who's to blame? Nietzsche is to blame. What's interesting, though, is that his point is that not that Nietzsche's bad, right? And therefore we should keep him away from American culture. But that Nietzsche is so good. That Nietzsche is so right. But that American culture is too slack, too insufficient, too weak, too small, yeah, to actually grasp the writings of this genius. And so one of the things I think is so interesting about an Alan Bloom is that by 1987, he's so important, right? Like, why does this book become an overnight success? I think it's because he hit a truth there, which is to say that Nietzsche is us. I think he's absolutely right. By 1987, Nietzsche is so thoroughly in our intellectual life, in our culture, but not in the way that Alan Bloom thought about it, right? Bunch of pygmies and versus the giant, but in the way that he enacted it, right? The enacting this proprietary Nietzsche. I have Nietzsche. Nietzsche spoke the truth. Nietzsche understood the horrible dangers of modernity. But it's only going to be, you know, the few, the Übermenschen, yeah, the exceptional who can understand it.
Like Bloom.
Like Bloom, of course, of course. So what I think the power of this book is that it essentially enacts all the pathos, all the longing, all the fear, all the joy of Nietzsche over the course of the century, and also, you know, testifies to why he's such a powerful influence, or as Bloom says, Nietzsche is us.
Well, that's another great aphorism, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's one reason we remember it. And we could, of course, go on many more hours with concept of Nietzsche and interpreting and perhaps misinterpreting some of those pronouncements of his. Our guest has been Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, and thanks for joining us for this hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.